messenger and your representative unto your creation, your great sign and big news. And bless Siddiqatu Tahira, Fatimatu Zahra, Master of Women of the Worlds. And bless the two grandchildren of the Messenger of Mercy and two Imams of Guidance, Hassan and Hussein, the two Masters of Youth of Paradise. And bless the Imams of Muslims, Ali son of Hussein, Muhammad son of Ali, Ja'far son of Muhammad, Musa son of Ja'far, Ali son of Musa, Muhammad son of Ali, Ali son of Muhammad, Hassan son of Ali, and their substitute, the guide and the guided. Your vicegerents unto your servants and your trustees in your lands with ample and everlasting blessings. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimmen Prez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
Heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
It destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroys Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a $1 trillion industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic, because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very explicitly edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching...
And why
was that? Yeah.
Because all of it was so... kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today, and it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come onto the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multimillion dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned the study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this $1 million contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. And I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
After watching this documentary, really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to watching the connections being made between the US military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity, and it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer it lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling, and you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter and he makes, you know, we have the biggest arms deal, for an inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrogant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making their statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached, at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization. But this was the first time it was actually industrialized. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been a Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, spent 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, you know, dozens of other places I've been and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. You know, especially having done it for 20 years, and, you know, yeah. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down, and they try to gag them. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
And it's, it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep the sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
well, Tessa? A marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... the African National Congress. Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary, and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in New Labour and was, the spiritual light here, who's going to bring all this hope, and yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you have Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud office, I believe. Having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him, and he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really.
And
he got away with it. But then he was, you know, Teflon Tony, you know, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming
They're documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. But yes, no, and the thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and they, if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Fiscal year 1999, 2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, 1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if
this
you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh during that clip. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing and he knew he could get away with it. And he has. You know, it was the one that was then ostracised and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, the funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of a, I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behaved literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted. And sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult. But I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes you question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary, then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
sorry, just a final thought on the film.
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, the people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Very, very powerful note to end it on. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
After Florida's Senate Republicans on Thursday, April 15th, passed an undemocratic anti-protest bill, the state's ACLU chapter condemned GOP lawmakers for aiming to shut down political speech they disagree with in a direct attack on the First Amendment and at the cost of black and brown people. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Racist, Unconstitutional, and Anti-Democratic. Florida Senate passes GOP anti-protest bill. Stay tuned for the details, please. Florida Senate Republicans on Thursday, April 15th, passed an undemocratic anti-protest bill. The state's ACLU chapter condemned GOP lawmakers for aiming to shut down political speech they disagree with in a direct attack on the First Amendment and at the cost of black and brown people. House Bill 1 is racist, unconstitutional, and anti-democratic, plain and simple. Maya Kubik, executive director of the ACLU of Florida, said in a statement. Kubik said the bill, first proposed by DeSantis last September in response to nationwide protests against police violence and passed last month by Republican lawmakers in the State House, was purposely designed to embolden the disparate police treatment we have seen over and over again directed towards black and brown people who are exercising their constitutional right to protest. It is no coincidence, Kubik continued, that HB 1 and its companion bill, Senate Bill 484, were introduced by politicians who harshly criticized millions of Floridians and Americans for demanding racial justice and police accountability. This is a bill that is a disgrace to our state, he added. The scientist described HB1 as his legislative priority, even though, according to ACLU of Florida, 95% of the protests in Florida last year were peaceful and required no police intervention whatsoever. The bill heads to the governor's desk as people in Minnesota and Illinois take to the streets to express opposition to recent police killings of unarmed individuals of color. Characterizing the measure as an attempt to chill and criminalize people for exercising their First Amendment right to peacefully advocate for social change, the ACLU of Florida explained the full ramifications of the legislation. By redefining rioting, the bill grants police officers broad discretion in deciding who could be arrested and charged with a third-degree felony at a protest and fails to provide protection for people who have not engaged in any disorderly and violent conduct. In Florida, a felony charge strips people of their voting rights. This bill would also hinder local governments from determining how to allocate law enforcement resources to address critical needs in their local communities. It allows the governor with the cabinet to usurp control of a city budget and amend it to their linking at the appeal of any county commissioner or state attorney, regardless of whether local elected officials approve of changes made in the budget. It would also shield violent counter-protesters from civil liability for killing a peaceful protester or demonstrator with their vehicle and make pulling down a Confederate flag a punishable offense for up to 15 years in prison. As March for Our Lives Florida, a student-led group fighting to end gun violence, noted in a statement, "This bill emboldens and protects white supremacists who seek to injure peaceful demonstrators, threatens peaceful protesters with a felony, and penalizes local municipalities that choose to divert funds to community-based violence intervention prevention programs." Progressives have been sounding the alarm that Republican lawmakers in multiple states are exploiting the deadly attack on the halls of Congress by a mob of then-President Donald Trump's supporters to push for anti-protest bills, which critics say have nothing to do with stemming the tide of far-right extremism and everything to do with suppressing left-wing dissent and quashing protests against police brutality, fossil fuel pipelines, and more, as Common Dreams reported earlier this year. Since the right-wing insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, at least 13 states have taken up legislation to crack down on protests, NBC News reported recently. In addition to Florida, legislators in Arizona, Indiana, Maryland, Minnesota, Mississippi, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Virginia, and Washington have introduced bills that critics say use the violence at the Capitol to justify the repression of Black Lives Matter and other social justice demonstrations. In Florida, Trump ally DeSantis promoted HB1 and SB 484 on January 6, the same day insurrectionists were storming the Capitol, as journalist Christopher Cook pointed out earlier this year. Journalist Ileana Hagena wrote at the time that DeSantis used the riots in Washington, D.C., attended by several new Confederates, as a pretext to make taking down Confederate status a felony in Florida. The Intercept's Alan Brown and Akilah Lacey have argued that the GOP's push for new anti-protest bills around the country reflects an attempt to rebrand earlier anti-democratic efforts to crack down on civil disobedience, taking advantage of outrage over the far-right coup attempt to undermine demonstrations for progressive causes. Florida's anti-protest bill remains highly unpopular. According to a poll conducted last month by Florida Politics, 63% of the state's voters view the legislation unfavorably. HB1 has also provoked opposition across the U.S. Last month, in a letter addressed to State House Speaker Chris Sprouls and State Senate President Wilson Simpton, more than 100 law professors throughout the country denounced the proposal, characterizing it as unconstitutional and morally unconscionable. And yet, as March for Our Lives Florida pointed out, Republican lawmakers passed the bill anyway, and DeSantis said in a statement that he looks forward to signing it. Despite opposition from a wide coalition of survivors of police violence, religious leaders, community leaders, business owners, students, and law enforcement agencies, the legislature prioritized the passage of this bill while millions of Floridians are still waiting for a living wage, COVID relief, affordable housing, and health care, the group said. Instead of serving the people of Florida, the governor has chosen to serve Trump, the far-right wing of his party, and violent white nationalists in their efforts to silence black and brown voices calling for racial justice, the group added. March for Our Lives Florida, our members, chapters, and supporters condemn the passing of HB1 and the failure of our lawmakers in Tallahassee to listen to the needs of their constituents. According to the Miami Herald, Senate Democrats called on major Republican political donors to pressure Governor Ron DeSantis to stop anti-mob legislation that deemed racist, unconstitutional, and partisan. In a call to grocery store chains, amusement parks, and utility companies that tend to make significant contributions to Florida Republicans, State Senator Perry Thurston said, "Don't sit on the sidelines. Do something. Take a position."
On Saturday, diplomats from the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreed to continue the negotiations as well as technical consultations within the next days. At the end of the talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi stressed that differences have not been settled yet. He reiterated that some serious disagreements need to be resolved during next negotiations. The senior Iranian diplomat's remarks were in line with what the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, previously said. The leader had earlier warned against protracted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear accord. The leader has dismissed the proposals by the U.S. during the negotiations. Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitment under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed. However, U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to the removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. According to the article by the Foreign Policy magazine, Washington is willing to only remove sanctions outlined in the nuclear deal.
but sanctions not inconsistent with the JCPOA will remain in place. That would mean the United States is seeking to divide anti-Iran sanctions into removable, irremovable, and negotiable sanctions. However, that could strike a heavy blow against the talks in Vienna to revive the deal, as far as removal of all sanctions is the only way to salvage the negotiations from collapse.
I've read several instances in American mainstream media referring to Robert Malley's effort right now as trying to strike what they're referring to as a Goldilocks-style deal to return to the JCPOA. And what is meant by that is a deal that is neither too hot or too cold, that strikes some sort of balance or that is just right. The sanctions that the United States has placed on Iran are illegal under international law. It is a fact that they were purposefully muddled and conflated with terrorism to make their lifting more difficult. And so this is just going to be something that the United States government is going to have to work out to bring itself back into the compliance with the deal that it signed in 2015 and United Nations Resolution 2231.
Last week, the European Union sanctioned 8 Iranian commanders and 3 entities over so-called human rights violations. The move was a big shock for Tehran, as it is involved in EU-mediated talks to revive the JCPOA. Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi lashed out at EU sanctions, saying they have undermined the talks in Vienna.
And we told them that even your human rights sanctions that you imposed 2 days ago, we consider as JCPOA-related sanctions, because right in the middle of the negotiations, you decided to impose sanctions. And that is certainly to undermine the current negotiations and to undermine JCPOA altogether. So as far as you are concerned, this is in fact a significant non-performance by European Union to impose new sanctions or new designations, as they call it.
Also, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, slammed the EU for imposing sanctions on Iran instead of condemning America's economic terrorism against 82 million Iranians and the incident at Natanz nuclear facility.
This proves that the EU has no place in the world. It proves that not only the EU follows U.S. policies, but it also follows the most extremist groups inside the U.S. and Israel.
The top Iranian diplomat called the EU sanctions destructive, saying Iran will respond to this action by imposing bans on European individuals.
I think that the most recent round of sanctions applied by the EU to Iran are purely to be used as a bargaining chip in the current talks in Vienna. The EU has not placed sanctions on Iran since 2013, and so therefore this application of sanctions against members of Iran's military coming now right in the middle of these very tendentious talks within Vienna, albeit so far constructive, is a clear sign that the EU is once again fulfilling its role as a vassal entity for the United States.
On Friday, Tehran announced that it has increased its nuclear activities despite the sabotage attack, and its first batch of 60% enriched uranium was ready at Natanz nuclear facility. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions and the acts of sabotage as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has taken back the momentum by making that announcement on Friday. Iran says it will not pay attention to Washington's rhetoric and that the ball is in the U.S. court to revive the deal if it really wants to do so.
The United States under President Joe Biden has taken a tougher stance against Russia. On Thursday, Biden said Washington is facing a national emergency, accusing Russia of interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and involvement in a major cyber espionage operation. Biden signed an executive order imposing sweeping sanctions against several Russian individuals and institutions, requiring the Treasury Department to block U.S. financial institutions from purchasing bonds from the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, the National Wealth Fund of the Russian Federation, or the Ministry of Finance of the Russian Federation after June 14, and from lending funds to these institutions. Also, The U.S. said it's expelling 10 personnel from Russia's diplomatic mission, claiming that some of them are representatives of intelligence services. But at the same time, the U.S. president called for de-escalation with Russia.
The way forward is through thoughtful dialogue and diplomatic process. The U.S. is prepared to continue constructively to move forward that process. My bottom line is this. Where it is in the interest of the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. If Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond.
Shortly after the announcement, the North Atlantic Council, the political decision-making body within NATO, released a statement in support of the U.S. measures.
Well, it seems to me that it's more appropriate, and probably has been done, for the Russians to declare a national emergency, because they are the ones that are threatened, not the U.S. The U.S. is intervening in a crisis which it helped to create through the support given during the Obama years to the color revolution in Ukraine, which was directed primarily against Russia on behalf of the Western intelligence forces, who felt, in the words of Brzezinski, that if Russia loses Ukraine, they become very weak.
The developments come amid heightened tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military have clashed in recent weeks. Moscow said it will ban a string of top officials from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, including his chief domestic policy advisor Susan Rice, from entering Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Chief Christopher Wray, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and several other officials will be barred. The ministry said the officials participated in the anti-Russian push of the U.S. politics. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow is also being asked to leave the country.
President Vladimir Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has recommended that U.S. envoy John Sullivan leave for Washington to conduct serious consultations.
Lavrov said Russia would ask 10 U.S. diplomats to leave the country in a tit-for-tat move. He said the activity of American funds and NGOs in Russia that interfere in the country's internal affairs would also be seized. Lavrov added that Moscow is also considering, quote, painful measures against U.S. businesses in Russia.
The policy as it's now formed is aimed at really reducing Russia as a major power. They're doing it primarily economically, but also I think what they want is they will not accept a Russia led by Vladimir Putin, but they want regime change. So it's really to create a world in which the United States sets the rules.
It appears that the U.S. and Russia are heading towards another Cold War. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
The war in Afghanistan has been a major foreign policy challenge for several U.S. presidents. The war, which began in 2001 under former President George W. Bush, has killed some 2,300 U.S. troops and cost American taxpayers more than $2 trillion. The protracted conflict has been widely described as futile. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that America will finally withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan in 2021.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Several thousand American forces remain part of the 9,600-strong NATO mission there. Under Biden's plan, the withdrawal is scheduled to begin on May the 1st and will be completed in September. The U.S. president seems confident about his withdrawal plan, but his initiative has been met with criticism. The Taliban called for the U.S. to abide by an agreement with the group, which was brokered in Doha, Qatar, last year. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump had agreed to pull out all troops from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The militant group warned that if the Doha agreement is breached, those who fail to comply with the deal will be held responsible for any possible problems. Russia's foreign ministry also said the newly announced withdrawal strategy violates America's previous promises. Meanwhile, the pullout plan comes at a time when Taliban militants are in control of large parts of Afghanistan after nearly two decades of the U.S.-led war against them. The almost 20-year war has wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and claimed tens of thousands of lives. Taliban militants who were forced out of power by the U.S. invasion in 2001 proved resilient and clawed back large parts of Afghanistan from foreign and government forces, especially in recent years. They are now in control of important parts of the country. They seem to be an indispensable part of Afghanistan's future. Critics of America's foreign policy say this exposes the futility of U.S. militarism in the region.
I believe that this conflict, when you analyze it, the only proper way to state it is that it was a total failure. The United States will try to spin this into a complicated story, into saying, you know, it's complicated, nobody, you know, there are no clear winners. But you think about the fact that they did the same similar thing even in Vietnam, when the Americans were dealt a sound crushing defeat.
The U.S.-led military campaign failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with a long list of problems such as poverty, unemployment, and illicit opium production. Some even go so far as to call war-torn Afghanistan a failed state. Meanwhile, the insecurity has provided a fertile ground for the growth of militant groups more extreme than the Taliban. Now foreign forces are finally planning to leave. Who is responsible for the mess that they're leaving behind? It's the Afghan people who have to put up with the unending misery every day. The departure of foreign forces this year could mark a new chapter for Afghans. Observers believe Afghans across the country, whether in the ranks of the Taliban or the government, have to put aside their differences and work together if they really want a future for their country.
Tensions are running high between Moscow and Kiev over the latest escalation in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. NATO has expressed concern over Russia's military buildup in the area.
We are seriously concerned by ongoing developments, and NATO is monitoring the situation very closely.
NATO's chief said Russia's move is unjustified. He called on Moscow to end the buildup in and around Ukraine and stop what he called its provocations and de-escalate immediately. Ukraine has also called for sanctions on Russia over the measure.
We need measures which will deter Russia and which will contain its aggressive intentions. This could be, as the Secretary General mentioned, a new round of sanctions which would raise the price of Russian aggression.
Russia, however, has its own argument and has warned against what it calls fueling belligerent sentiment in Ukraine. Moscow accuses the U.S. and other NATO members of turning Ukraine into a, quote, a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to Kiev. It says the military support is a serious challenge to Russia, adding that Moscow would do everything possible to ensure its security. But what is Russia-Ukraine tension all about? A few weeks ago, Moscow deployed troops along the border with Ukraine following reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in Donbas. Moscow accused Kiev of taking provocative measures near its border. In return, Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in eastern Ukraine. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. The tension between Russia and Ukraine has drawn reactions from other countries. In a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart in Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Russia's military buildup very provocative.
The United States stands firmly behind the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and I'm here to reaffirm that with the foreign minister today. And that's particularly important at a time when we're seeing, unfortunately, Russia take very provocative actions.
Blinken had warned that if Russia acts recklessly or aggressively, there will be consequences. France and Germany have also called on Russia to halt a troop buildup on the border with Ukraine and reaffirm their support for Kiev in its confrontation with Moscow. Meanwhile, foreign ministers of the G7 countries have issued a joint statement calling the movement of Russian troops near the border with Ukraine threatening and destabilizing. But Turkey, a NATO member, had a different stance. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara was working to end the Ukraine-Russia tension while voicing military cooperation and support for Ukraine.
This is a very serious issue, and it seems like escalation comes from Ukrainian and NATO side. For some reason, I suspect the new Biden administration, they want to test Russia and Putin's resolve. Maybe they have a feeling that they can push the situation further, but it's a very kind of naive hope. Basically, what everybody has to be aware that East Ukraine doesn't want to go back. They don't want to obey Kiev. They want to be either on their own or join Russia if that works out. They don't want to be part of Ukraine.
Many believe that the U.S. decision to send warships to the volatile area would complicate the situation.
That's exactly what it is. I think United States want to test Russia. They also, it's for United States, we have to be aware that we have a change of scenery. Many people who were in State Department and the government who were ousted under Trump, they came back. And they want to resurrect their failed policy vis-a-vis Ukraine. They started the whole thing. They started, this campaign of splitting Ukraine apart, pulling it toward, NATO. So they think that they can, try it. And if, while trying it, they are testing, Putin's resolve, Russian resolve. They also don't have much to lose. It's not their soldiers who are going to get killed there. It'll be either Eastern Ukrainians or Kiev forces will be killed. And then it'll be like the usual scenario, usual script, which we very well know. No matter what happens, Russia will be blamed, new sanctions will be introduced, and among the sanctions, United States love to do the sanctions.
With tensions simmering in eastern Ukraine, U.S. media are happy to push the narrative that Russia is the aggressor and is preparing to invade its neighbor. The reports ignore the fact that the Donetsk and Luhansk republics in eastern Donbass region declared independence from Ukraine back in 2014 in response to a U.S.-backed coup. It seems that the United States, along with its longtime ally NATO, are establishing a united front against Russia. What is certain, however, is that such escalations risk spiraling out of control and sucking all sides into a vortex that would be in no one's favor.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Capitol Police knew ahead of January 6th that Congress itself was the target of the Donald Trump-fueled mob that violently breached the Capitol. But the police department's leaders ignored warnings and were thoroughly unprepared for the mob. A new report from the department's watchdog has found, says Sharon Zhang Ryder in an article published under the heading, Capitol Police knew Trump's mob would attack Congress but were unprepared anyway. Stay tuned for the details, please. Capitol Police knew ahead of January 6th that Congress itself was the target of the Donald Trump-fueled